I'll take it from here. Yes, actually I'll talk about turbulent burning fronts in type 1A supernovae for about 90% of the talk. So most of this will be about type 1A supernovae. Here's a list of my collaborators. I've done this work mostly in collaboration with Wolfgang Hillebrand's group at the MPA in Munich, and lately with Bob Rosner's ASCII Flash Center at the University of Chicago. And most of what I know about turbulent combustion I learned from Alan Kirstein at the Combustion Research Facility at Sandia, Livermore. Oh, here comes the laser. Thank you. So to set the stage, I'd like to give you a few examples where turbulent burning fronts are important in astrophysical phenomena. One example are classical novae, which are believed to be the runaway of accreted hydrogen on the top of white dwarfs. Another one is X-ray bursts, where the accretion is on top of a neutron star, and the material that runs away is either hydrogen or helium or a mixture of both. And then type 1A supernovae, where the standard model is that the white dwarf actually explodes completely. So it's a complete disruption without any compact remnants. And this is what I'll talk about most. But in all of these cases, the standard scenario involves accretion from a binary companion, accretion onto that compact object, and ignition of the runaway occurs under very degenerate conditions of the material, which leads to very high temperatures at the time that the actual explosion starts. And that means that at this point, the reaction rates of the thermonuclear reactions are already very temperature dependent, and that gives rise to highly localized burning fronts in many cases. And this is what really the burning front means, is that you have a highly localized sheet of reacting material that propagates when it's laminar, mostly by thermal conduction, and then when it becomes unstable and turbulent, this turbulence is very important in the mixing and the propagation of these burning fronts. So this is really the framework for what I'll talk about. In classical novae, the burning front really isn't all that thin. If you look at the region where hydrogen is burnt, it's in what the combustion community would call a well-stirred reactor regime. So it's really very well mixed by the turbulence. In this case, turbulence is internally driven convection, which is just driven by the heat release in the hydrogen burning. However, there are localized spots of more intense burning due to the dredge up of carbon and oxygen from the underlying white dwarf. So here, one of the main questions, and this is really all I'll say about novae, is to what extent does this internally driven convection dredge up material from the underlying white dwarf? That is one of the key questions that involves turbulence. In X-ray bursts, the situation is much more complex. There's a lot of data coming in these days from very highly time-resolved X-ray observations, which show oscillations during the burst, for instance, which are very difficult to explain. So far, it is even disputed whether the burning takes place as a subsonic deflagration front or as a detonation, which is a supersonic shock-driven burning front. And I'll say a little bit more about these two types a bit later. And so it's really difficult at this point to judge how important turbulent will be in these models. So they're at a much earlier state of investigation. On the other hand, type 1A supernovae have been investigated for about 40 years now, and there it is very well known that turbulent burning fronts are at the heart of explaining the explosion scenario. And that is one of the reasons why I'll focus entirely on type 1A supernovae here. The other is that this is really the field of my interest, so I don't know too much more about the others. Here is a type 1A supernova. This is the astronomical part of the talk. They are very bright. At peak light, they come up to about 20 to 30 percent of the light, the total light emitted by their host galaxy. And that makes them prime candidates for using them as standard candles. And you'll definitely have heard about that use as well. This is a summary of the observables that we have for type 1A supernovae. This is a little animation that you can find on the webpage of the Supernova Cosmology Project at LBL. They are very bright optical transients. They come in two types, type 1 and type 2. Type 1A are very special in the sense that they are believed to be thermonuclear explosions, whereas all other types, type 1B, C, and type 2s, are believed to be gravitational collapse of very massive stars. Type 1s are spectroscopically classified as the ones that have no hydrogen in their spectra. They do show very strong absorption lines in the early spectra of intermediate mass elements, and that's a key indication for the explosion mechanism. I'll come back to that later. And they show iron lines in the late spectra at very high velocities. So you have to build an explosion model that is extremely powerful. They're found in all types of galaxies, including elliptical galaxies, and that means that their progenitor systems must have very long lifetimes. So the standard paradigm for type 1A supernovae has been standing since 1960, the paper by Hoyle and Fowler, namely that type 1A supernovae are thermonuclear explosions of white dwarfs that reach the Chandrasekhar limit. And this really is consistent with all the observations, and it's really the only standard model, or the only model that is fully consistent with all the observations. In order to drive this white dwarf to criticality, you have to feed it. So again, it sits in a binary system, which is depicted here. It accretes material from a binary companion, and the idea is that now it keeps accreting for so long that it grows to the Chandrasekhar mass, at which point it becomes unstable, and shortly before it really becomes dynamically unstable, it heats sufficiently at the center to start a carbon and oxygen runaway. And that is what ultimately drives the explosion. And the reason why there are such powerful bombs is that, again, electron degeneracy decouples T from rho, and the carbon plus carbon reaction is temperature dependent to a power of between 20 and 40, depending on the condition. So it's really very, very critical. And once that stage has been reached, once the reaction has really started to go, the white dwarf burns in a matter of about 2 seconds. And this is what I'll call the actual explosion. Now, until a couple of years ago, the main goal for theory was to build a consistent explosion model. But as of 1998, the cosmologists have provided us with a whole new set of goals, and that is to prove or disprove that type 1A supernovae are standard candles. And you've probably seen these plots a couple of times. Type 1A supernovae, because they are so bright and because they're such a homogeneous class, meaning that they don't vary very much from event to event, are very powerful for uses as a cosmological standard candle. And interpreting their luminosity distance as a function of redshift indicates that the universe is accelerating at, or is expanding at, an accelerating pace, and that gives rise to the interpretation of there being a cosmological constant. Now, this has really given us a kickstart in the supernova theory part, because now, of course, what you want to know is whether the supernovae that you observe at high redshifts are the same beasts that you observe at low redshifts, or whether by some magic they have grown in size as they come closer to you. So this is all I'll say about the cosmology business, but it makes life very interesting for us, A, because more people are interested in type 1A supernovae, and B, because there's a whole wealth of data coming in to constrain supernova models. Okay, let's move on to very, very small scales. Since I will use these terms very often during the talk, let me define what deflagrations and detonations are. There are two modes for one-dimensional burning fronts to propagate. The subsonic mode is called a deflagration. Here, the density declines in the burnt material. The propagation is completely due to thermal conduction, in our case, by the degenerate electrons. And you can calculate the width and the speed of these flames by just one-dimensional simulations of the whole set of equations, the microphysics is fairly well understood. So we think we understand the equation of state, we think we understand the transport coefficients and so forth, and the reaction rates. So this is very tightly constrained, and you find that the deflagrations at conditions near the center of a Chandrasekhar mass by dwarf have a thickness of roughly a micron to 10 microns. So they're really thin, and they propagate at about a tenth of a percent of the speed of light. So really, here's my toy model for a thermonuclear deflagration. They're thinner than this piece of paper, and they propagate laminarly at a tenth of a percent of the speed of light. So in actual numbers, it's comparable to the thickness. I mean, that is what defines the flame thickness. It's the diffusion length. So
the principal controller will have that property, but the other ones, the other part of it.
Oh, that is for the electrons. The electrons dominate thermal transport.
So the photons have longer
beams. No, shorter, much shorter. Yes. Because the electrons are almost fully degenerate.
Uh-huh.
So photons are fairly unimportant at this point. So this is the subsonic part. And then, of course, detonations are possible, which are burning fronts that are driven by a shock, and then they maintain that shock by the burning, by release of energy behind the shock. So they're self-maintained shocks traveling through the material. And here the speed is roughly the speed of sound, which in a relativistic degenerate material is roughly the speed of light, and they're about 100 to 1,000 times thicker than the deflagration fronts, which still doesn't make them very thick. In principle, both of those modes are allowed by the equations, and which one of those is actually realized in the explosion depends on the initial conditions, and those are basically not known at all. So we have to depend on secondary indications which one of those actually happens. That's one of the big questions. And also, both modes are hydrodynamically unstable once you go to three dimensions, linearly. Nonlinearly, they become stable, except when you switch on gravity, and then again, you become unstable. I'll talk a little more about this. So in order to give you an idea where turbulence and turbulent mixing comes into the picture, I'll give you a brief sketch or set of cartoons of the anatomy of the explosion, guiding you through various regimes that we believe occurred during the explosion. So ignition is a very complicated phenomenon that we really ignore for the purpose of studying the dynamic part of the explosion. It is believed to be preceded by about a millennium of strong reactive core convection, and at some point the dynamical or the turbulence timescale, the convective timescales, become comparable to the reaction timescales because the reaction timescales become shorter and shorter, and at that point all bets are off for mixing length theory, and really we don't have a handle on the evolution of the core at that stage. It is made even more complicated by the presence of the convective Urca process, which is a convectively driven neutrino-antineutrino loss process, which may or may not cool the core even further. So it is really complicated. What we need to know for multidimensional explosion models, for instance, is the location and the topology of the initial flame front. We want to know at how many points this flame ignites. And so far, we're just using this as a free parameter. We simply don't really know what the flame looks like at the point of ignition. And this is just a side remark. This topology and the number of points of the initial flame currents may actually be important to find some dependence of the supernova explosion strength on the initial composition of the star. And that may be important for the cosmologists. So now, given that you don't really know much about the initial conditions, why don't you just assume that you ignite as a detonation, the whole star is disrupted, and everybody's happy. And we don't have to worry much about turbulence because the detonation is supersonic. However, it is known that if you detonate a Chandrasekhar mass white dwarf in its equilibrium condition, you burn the material almost entirely to nickel. You form a big clump of nickel, but as I told you, you observe very strong absorption lines of intermediate mass elements. So really, knowing the explosion products rules out the pure detonation mode. And this makes this problem so complicated, because now we know that we have to start the explosion in a subsonic mode in order to allow the star to pre-expand, but then later on we have to accelerate that mode in order to burn most of the star before it's fully expanded and quenches the burning. So it's a race between the expansion of the star that we know has to be there and the burning front, and in the end you want to get a powerful explosion. This is really the whole problem of this game. Okay, now assuming that you start ignition as a deflagration mode. Initially, as I told you, the flame is extremely thin and turbulence is very weak. The main source for turbulence, we believe, is the Rayleigh-Taylor instability of the flame front. You produce hot, less dense material in the center underneath denser cold material outside, so the flame front itself, being the interface of those two, is Rayleigh-Taylor unstable. It forms bubbles. These bubbles form secondary instabilities, and so the idea is that you quickly establish a fully turbulent regime around the flame front, and that increases the surface of the flame, and therefore also increases the global reaction rate. And that's really what we want to know, is how much does turbulence increase the global reaction rate, and can it give rise to a successful explosion? Initially, as I said, the flame is very thin, so we're in what the combustion engineers call the flamelet burning regime, where turbulence on very small scales is unable to disrupt the laminar flame structure. So if you look at small enough scales, the flame still has the same structure as the one-dimensional solution, and the only effect of turbulence is on large scales, where the flame distorts and wrinkles, or the turbulence distorts the flame front. So again, if you look at this model here, all that turbulence does is this. So the surface area increases, and therefore the total speed, which you can parameterize now as a turbulent flame speed, is much larger than the laminar flame speed. And what we want to know is, how can we model this turbulent flame speed? And again, in the initial flamelet regime, there is an asymptotic scaling that seems to apply very well to our case, and that is, as long as the laminar flame speed is much, much smaller than the typical turbulence speed on the largest scales, then transport is completely dominated by turbulence on these scales, and then you end up roughly in a regime where the turbulent flame speed becomes equal to the turbulence speed. So it completely decouples from microphysics. And not only is this true by dimensional analysis, it also seems to be confirmed by experiments and by numerical experiments that I'll show you a little bit later. So in this early phase, we have some sort of handle on how to model the turbulent flame speed. And it has nothing to do with thermonuclear reaction rates anymore. Okay, so here is where the problem begins. At some point, turbulence on those small scales becomes strong enough to affect the laminar flame structure. And now, as soon as mixing on the scale of the flame thickness becomes more important than thermal conduction by the electrons, this flame regime no longer holds. And this is what is known as the distributed burning regime, where you form little disconnected reaction centers that look completely different from a laminar flame. This is a very poorly understood regime. By dimensional analysis, still, you may use asymptotic scalings on very large scales that decouple the turbulent flame speed from the microphysics, but this is much less understood. So this is one of the big problems at this moment. It is made more complicated by the fact that the Prandtl numbers for thermonuclear flames are much, much smaller than for chemical flames. They're far smaller. They're around 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. That means that thermal conduction is much more important than viscosity. And And in terms of the flame, it means that within one flame thickness, you can actually have smaller eddies that live within the flame. So this is one of the key issues at the moment for modeling. The open questions here are, does the turbulent flame phase release enough energy to completely disrupt the star? If it does so, can it reproduce the observed high ejector velocities? Is it powerful enough? And in order to obtain this, we know that the turbulent flame speed must become at least 30% sonic. Buoyancy alone, the Rayleigh-Taylor instability alone, does not seem to be able to reach up to such high speeds. So now we're thinking about feedback mechanisms of the flame-generated turbulence that may help here. But this is really the big question. Can the turbulence be driven to such strong values? There is an alternative, and that was proposed by Alexei Kotlov and by Stan Woosley in the beginning of the 90s, namely that later on during this subsonic expansion phase, a transition takes place from deflagration at one point, just at one point in the star. This transition takes place from a deflagration mode to a detonation mode. That was called the delayed detonation model in the Type 1A supernova community, and it's known as deflagration-detonation transitions in the combustion community. And it's observed fairly frequently in laboratory experiments where you have turbulent flames propagating down a pipe, for instance, and at some point, if the turbulent flame speed becomes large enough, you see a very drastic change in the propagation mode, which then steepens into a detonation. And that's called a deflagration-detonation transition. What is not known and very difficult to investigate is whether this can take place in unconfined media. In all of the cases that are known in laboratories, walls play some sort of role. At the moment, I think it's safe to say that we do not understand whether this can take place in unconfined media. Yes?
Could you show the hydrogen then in the
mouth? There is no hydrogen. This is carbon and oxygen, and this is mainly nickel, iron peak nuclei. The white dwarf consists of carbon and oxygen to begin with. So the hydrogen that we dumped onto it burned stably during the accretion to carbon and oxygen. So there is no hydrogen. You don't see hydrogen in the spectra, so you have to get rid of all of your hydrogen. Okay, let's go on. Once you have this delayed detonation, all the rest is easy. Then the star is fully disrupted. You produce enough energy to explain the ejector velocities, and everything is fine. But you have to invoke this strange mechanism for deflagration-detonation transitions, which we now believe is deeply connected with locally quenching a thermonuclear flame. So one of the key questions there is, what does it take to blow out a thermonuclear flame locally? Can turbulent strain at some point distinguish thermonuclear burning? Because then, as you reignite, you have to reignite in a very homogeneous mode in order to get a detonation. Right. Okay, there's an alternative, and that is if you don't release enough energy on the first try, the star recollapses, and then you have another chance to invoke a detonation during the recollapse. But that's really just a variation of the delayed detonation model. Okay, so what can you do to try and understand what's going on here? Since we don't have experiments for thermonuclear flames, all we can do is computational experiments of various flavors. The goals are, of course, that we want to understand these small-scale flame turbulence interactions and use this information then, A, to understand whether or not deflagration-detonation transitions can take place, and B, to develop subgrid-scale models for large-scale explosion models that cannot resolve these small-scale interactions. And the methods that we use are direct numerical simulations, so simulations where you try to resolve all the dissipation scales, and simplified toy models that try to isolate some dynamical effect that we think is important. And I'll show you an example of the latter. This is something that I did with Alan Kirstein some time ago. One of the questions for an idealized, very thin flame that can really be modeled as a propagating jump in density, or you don't even have to think of it as a density jump, just a propagating interface of fluid A and fluid B. One of the questions here is if you subject this propagating interface to turbulence, is there a lower scale, a small scale cutoff for perturbations? And this smallest scale where the flame is wrinkled is known as the Gibson scale, due to Carl Gibson, who's here in the audience. It has not really been confirmed in experiments because it's very difficult to obtain high enough resolution to see these cutoff scales. So what we designed here is really the most idealized version of a thin mixed flame that we can think of, and it's essentially a cellular automaton model. So the assumptions are that the flame is infinitely thin. It's just an interface between fluid A and fluid B. The flame is passively advected, so there's no feedback of the burning onto the turbulence. And turbulence really is just a mixing process in this model that acts on multiple lengths and timescales with a prescribed spectrum. So it has nothing to do at this point with solving Navier-Stokes equations. All that we do is we mix this material with a prescribed power spectrum. No. This is really not a hydro model at all. You could. But at this point, this is as simple as you can make it. The realization that we chose is two discrete states, 0 and 1, burnt and unburnt. Discrete time steps representing the flame crossing time of each zone. And then during each time step, each neighbor to a burnt zone that is still unburnt is burnt. So that represents laminar propagation locally. And then the turbulent mixing is realized by sinus wave perturbations that are just implemented as a mapping of the whole grid onto itself. And I'll show you a demonstration of this on just one length scale. So it started out with just a plain line. Then you mix once, you get this sine wave. You mix twice, now in the opposite direction, and you get this. And this goes on and on and on. So you mix further and further, and you end up with something that looks more and more like a Kelvin-Helmholtz roll, but it really has nothing to do with Navier-Stokes equations. You can do this on many, many scales with this prescribed power spectrum, and then you end up with something that looks in a steady state sort of like this. And then you can collect statistics. And since this model includes all of what we believe is important to prescribe this cutoff scale, this model should also show that cutoff scale, and indeed it does. We found that this Gibson scale actually exists independent of the power spectrum for the mixing. These are all very different experiments, and they can all be collapsed onto a single line where that is normalized to the Gibson scale. So they all turn over to smoothness here. You can also deduce the fractal dimension of this interface. And yes, we actually find one. And it coincides with what Alan Kirstein predicted in a paper earlier. However, there are lots of experimental papers that claim that they found fractal scaling for their surfaces. And I don't think that those should be taken too seriously, because we were only able to find believable fractal scaling at numerical or effective Reynolds numbers above 4,000, and very few experiments reach this. And DNS are far from reaching this. Since this model, since this method is so cheap and so simple, we were able to obtain very high Reynolds numbers. Here's another experiment that we did. Another very simplified flame. And here, the flame is modeled as a reaction diffusion equation of some progress variable, which you could think of as temperature, for instance. Which lives on a turbulent flow. But now the turbulent flow is really turbulent. It's a driven, incompressible turbulent flow field. And the question that we asked here is how strong does turbulence have to be in order to deviate from the flame rate regime? In other words, when does this geometric model that I showed you, that all that happens is the wrinkling of something that is unchanged on small scales. When does this break down? How strongly do you have to stir the flow? And surprisingly, we weren't able to find that transition. So far, by numerical restrictions, we weren't able to drive the flow strongly enough to find any deviations from the flamelet scaling regime. And that's very encouraging because it confirms that the flamelet scaling regime is valid and we can use it in subgrid scale models. But we still have to go further and find where it breaks down. Another question is, when can you quench a thermonuclear flame? How strong does a vortex have to be in order to locally extinguish a thermonuclear flame? So what we're doing here in work with Mike Singali in Chicago is to send a thermonuclear flame, again, on very, very small scales. So this is really a cubic millimeter, and send this through a vortex pair. The idea being that a vortex pair is really the worst thing that can happen to a thermonuclear flame because the strain is strongest here at the tip. And then we see whether or not it can be extinguished. This is work in progress. These are really just very early pictures, and you see that the reaction rate actually decreases at this point, but we don't know if it decreases far enough. Again, the question is important for the deflagration detonation transition. If we can show that it's impossible to quench this flame, the deflagration detonation transition it becomes very, very difficult to justify. Yes? That's the DNS, yes, with the full thermonuclear reactions and conduction and everything. No, it was the flame. It was no deflagration front, a subsonic flame front. Okay. No, because you're changing the gradients. You're changing the diffusion reaction structure, and so locally you can diffuse heat out of the reacting material and therefore cool it because you can steepen the gradients. That's the idea. We don't know yet. I mean, we'd be happy if we could extinguish it at one point. And actually, there are some reasons that we believe that it's completely impossible to quench a thermonuclear flame. There are some arguments that I can't go into. And I think it just doesn't happen. Okay. So another question is, what happens to turbulence that is recollapsing? And that's important in the framework of these recollapsing detonation models. So once you have some seed turbulence and now you start to collapse the whole star, how does the turbulent field react? And then once you switch on the burning, how does the burning interact with this squished turbulence? And that, again, is a DNS that is being done by Jonathan Dersey in Chicago. And here's a very preliminary movie. So this is an initial turbulent field that is squished by the outer boundary conditions. And we haven't really analyzed this much. All you can see here is that the turbulence does spin up as you would expect. Yes, this is 3D, I believe. It may be one of the very early preliminary 2D tests. At this point, you wouldn't actually see this, I guess. But it's definitely going to be 3D for the real work. Okay, so finally, the real explosion model will have to cover the scales of the star. We want to know whether this thing explodes or not. And that really is a large eddy simulation. The term is very familiar to combustion engineers and in the geophysical science, not so much in the astrophysical science. So let me define large eddy simulations. You solve the reactive Navier-Stokes equations on large scales. You invoke some filter on your smallest resolved scale, and then you model the unresolved scales with some phenomenologically motivated subgrid scale model. And in our case, of course, the most important thing that you have to model is the reaction rate, the unresolved turbulence and turbulent flame speed. Now, most astrophysical simulations are LES by necessity, since you very rarely can resolve all dynamical scales. What you need is a three-dimensional compressible hydrocode for the large scales, with all the bells and whistles, self-gravity, and so forth, and a subgrid scale model for the small scales that most importantly models turbulent combustion in the flamelit and distributed burning regimes. And that is really what most of the work goes into these days. Yes, thank you. Here's an example of a preliminary large eddy simulation that was done by Martin Reinecke in Munich. So in in addition to the subgrid scale modeling for the unresolved terms, you have to find a way to describe the flame front on your large scale grid. And it's not numerically simple to model a propagating density jump. That's all I will say at this point, but it's really the most difficult part of this simulation. Here we're using a capturing tracking scheme based on a level set method, and it's fairly accurate. We believe that it's at the moment it's one of the best methods to prescribe this flame. The subgrid scale speed, the turbulent flame speed here, is given just simply by the asymptotic regime that I mentioned in the beginning, namely that the turbulent flame speed is completely independent from microphysics and it just scales with the turbulent or with the turbulence intensity on the scale of your grid. Of course, you have to correct for numerical dissipation on this scale already, so it's still up to an order of or a coefficient of a few. But basically, the scaling goes with the turbulence intensity on the grid scale. So once you do that, you can look at a white dwarf initial model. You ignite a small bubble slightly off center. This is really the weakest way you can ignite the star, and then you can watch it go and see the Rayleigh-Taylor instability develop. See this mushroom structure. The bubble floats up. It spawns off secondary structures, and this surface propagates in on small scales, and it also produces more and more surface area. So this is, as I said, the weakest ignition. You can, of course, ignite at many points, and then you get a much stronger explosion, but this is to show you what the dynamics of this explosion looks like. And in the end, of course, what you hope is that you can create a model that becomes resolution independent, because that ultimately is a test of whether your subgrid scale model works. It's a very weak test, but it's the best that we have at the moment. Oh, this is a two-dimensional simulation. So this assumes equatorial and rotational symmetry. This is the equator. So the topology of this bubble is really a torus. That, of course, it's unrealistic, but at the moment, we're just now starting to do 3D simulations, but this is all I have a movie for. And of course, it's not well justified to use a three-dimensional subgrid scale model for 2D simulation, so we're aware of that, but this was the first stage. As I said, you want something that becomes independent of resolution, and in the beginning it looked like we were very far from getting it. The further we increased our resolution, this is 256, 512, 1024, and 2048 grid zones in each direction, so squared, we got more and more energy. So clearly this was not a converging series. We found out that we had done something wrong in the subgrid scale model, so now at least it converges. It's still not fully clear whether we are now doing everything right in the subgrid scale model, but this looks much more encouraging now. And this is really what you want to get in the end. Okay, let me summarize. Turbulent thermonuclear flame fronts are important to explain thermonuclear transients that are observed in astrophysics. And we have to understand the interaction of turbulence and nuclear burning on scales from below a millimeter down to, say, a micron, up to roughly 1,000 kilometers, which is the scale of the white dwarf radius, in order to build realistic explosion models. And so far, most of this work has been done in the context of type 1a supernovae. There, for type 1a supernovae, just reading and trying to adapt the methods that have been developed for turbulent premixed combustion has led to a lot of progress in the last years, because we didn't have to reinvent all of those wheels. And actually, there are a lot of analogies between premixed chemical flames and thermonuclear flames that we can use. And so we think that we have some handle on the physics. We need to understand the feedback effect of the flame onto the turbulence more, and the probability for deflagration detonation transitions. At the moment, it looks like those are hydrodynamically challenged, but we don't know yet. And finally, I think that type 1a supernovae are a great laboratory for a lot of fun physics, and I hope that I was able to convey that fascination to you. Thank you. It is important in some contexts. For the very large scales, I agree that this is nonlinear Rayleigh-Taylor mixing, which is not necessarily the same as standard Kolmogorov incompressible turbulence. On smaller and smaller scales, the idea is that due to secondary instabilities, the turbulence becomes more and more isotropic. Density contrast becomes less and less important, and you end up in something that really resembles fully developed turbulence. That is really not all that important in the modeling itself. This is just the concept. It's a conceptual problem. There are some arguments that we can discuss that this really takes place. So one of the questions is what really is your cascade? Is it dominated by kinetic energy cascading down, or is it dominated by density fluctuations that drive the Rayleigh-Taylor instability? And right now it really looks like this buoyancy-driven turbulence ends up in a Kolmogorov scaling on small enough scales. That's the latest that we understand. That's what I meant by secondary instabilities. You produce Kelvin Helmholtz on the surface and so forth. And so we're looking at that. For now we have some semi-analytical arguments. We have some arguments from simplified turbulence models that give the Kolmogorov cascade, but it's still important. But again, for the actual explosion models, there's no assumption about the cascade that's built into these models. Okay.
I wouldn't have any trouble calling that turbulence going from small scales to large because it's the inertial vortex forces that will drive turbulence in this cascade that's going to go up. My question was about the role of your Prandtl number in quenching the flame. Is that what your approach is?
It is a very important issue. It's one of the open, or it's the biggest difference between everything that has been investigated in laboratory experiments and to our situation is that our Prandtl numbers are so small, and so we have to include this in the investigation. In the DNS, we can not reach realistically small Prandtl numbers because of numerical restrictions, but we are definitely below one. So we try to capture this effect by doing DNS with a small Prandtl number. It's electron diffusion. But degenerate electrons.
Okay.
Fully degenerate, almost fully degenerate electrons.
You're using a lot of the language of chemical combustion,
yes.
Which is, of course, based on that balance of diffusive process and reaction motor by the kinetics, which in turn assumes an underlying Maxwell Boltzmann gap. So I was wondering, nuclear combustion,
No, the Arrhenius part is not true. I mean, our reaction rates scale differently, but that in most parts of the argument is not the biggest difference. So I agree that our reaction term has a different dependence on temperature than chemical reactions. And we're aware of that, and that is included in the DNS, for instance. But for using concepts like the flamelet regime, all that you really have to know is that there is a reaction zone of limited size where unburnt material is converted to burnt material. And of course, the actual structure of this flame is different for chemical flames and for thermonuclear flames.
Okay.
Transport, again, also is different, of course, and that's why we have such different Prandtl numbers, because it's dominated by degenerate electrons. What that does is it changes the transport coefficients, and again, you know how to include those into the equations. But again, the structure of the flame is still unburnt material, diffusion of heat out of the burnt material that burns the material right at the flame front, and then somewhere far behind it's burnt material. And that's really all that enters into these arguments about burning regimes. For more specific answers, of course, where the transition takes place and so forth, you have to look into the kinetics. And we do that with the simulations.
Secondary instability, the same instability, but it just looks different. And that deposition of vorticity through baryocinic processes is a very fundamental because whenever you have a sharp gradient, and a big criticism of all this is that the lower Mohr scheme by PPM, which is third order, do not do an adequate job at sharp instability. So you're really disturbing the nature of the fundamental turbulence that wants to arise by trying to do a simulation.
I agree that there are these problems for Rayleigh-Taylor instability as such, even without the burning, and it's even made even more complex by the interface actually being a reactive interface. Yes, we know that, and we try to capture these effects somehow in the modeling. But yes, it is not necessarily rigorous. Mm-hmm. I know.
And he said, and I think it's well known, that the only thing they can capture is the lower order energy statistics. They can't capture anything else. Nothing associated with transport or structure. And I think you want to be aware of that. It's a very interpolatory field.
But how does that actually change the behavior of
the flame, all this flame gun stuff is based on, is associated with what I just said, baryocinic processes. Inhomogeneous flow. All these other models, large A simulation models, have been developed and validated only for homogeneous consensus density.
It depends on what level of sophistication you want large eddy simulations to work. At the level of sophistication that we're trying to achieve here, I don't think these differences make a big difference. All that we assume, or that we model with a subgrid scale model, is the turbulent flame speed, in the assumption that it's in the asymptotic scaling regime of the flame burning regime. And that, I think, is a very different question from what you mentioned. I agree that if you look at more subtle issues, then of course LES is questionable, but it's still in many cases the best thing you can do. And therefore, I still think that we're doing the right thing, but of course being aware that it's not the final answer.
One last question from Professor Spiegel.
In all the arguing that we have to realize there are many forms of turbulence, but once it becomes intense that the hardcore fine structure turbulence is there, and why I mention this is that in experiments with intense turbulence is there is the process of entrainment, which is here a vital X factor.
Yes.
And as far as I know, one cannot produce simulations that do entrainment, even though they're relatively simple within the lab. And I think entrainment may be the single most important contributor of turbulence to this process. So I wondered if you had tried putting any of that in there just as a
putting it in addition to the large-scale solver. I'll be happy for suggestions. At the moment, I wouldn't know how to put it in. But it's.
I think time is running on, so can I cut the discussion and encourage people to discuss this further?
Right.
So my pleasure. That is going to be our second speaker, a professor, and you'll talk about magnetic.